Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello,
Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies that they love and the traces of the one reality that they see underneath.
Right. And we kind of have a unique one today. Episode yeah. number 36. And we're going to talk about The Killer Angels by Michael Shera.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a historical novel. It's interesting to think of it as a piece of, like historical reporting. You know, how would you, I don't know that anybody had done this before him. Well, there's been historical novels, but in his introduction.
But where they went, yeah, they went back to like source materials, or he went back to the people's letters and journals and.
Right. So it's a piece of
kind
of history,
cut through the historians.
Yeah, but he did say that the characterizations were his. And, that makes it interesting. Because you come away from this book, you know, thinking you know something about Robert E. Lee and others, of course. But, you know, do you really? That's a question that I have.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Because what he says is that everything about the battle is what happened, although he had to choose sometimes between conflicting reports between like two people's letters about something or their opinions about why something happened or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he said the thing that got me was when he said that he changed some of the language. And it was at that point, because I was rereading it when I was halfway through the book, and I suddenly went, oh my gosh, this is what these people said, or as they reported it to others, you know, or wrote it in their journals or whatever, which was really impressive. And then he said, the interpretation of character is my own. So I just assumed that the things that people were thinking was his spin on it.
Right. Yeah. And, their motivations for the actions that they took, I would expect.
Right.
The ones that aren't obvious.
Well, and we could talk about this, I guess, after we get into the book more, because what it made me do is, okay, I grew up in Kansas. I'm living in Texas, which, as we were saying right before the podcast, Texas is not the South. As people in the South will tell you, and people in Texas will tell you, and it's not the Southwest.
It's its own direction.
It is its own place. But they came in late, to the whole thing, I guess, as a state or a country, no, state, and or territory, whatever it was. Anyhow, I should know this better, but I don't. They were on the Civil War side. And the thing that I found interesting is I wound up talking about this book with Tom, my husband, and Rose, our youngest daughter, who's about 21 and 22, I guess now. And no matter where we grew up, we all had you love General Lee. You just love him. He was true to his family and his, even though he knew he should fight on the side of the North, he went for the South and you respected why. Sherman, hate Sherman. He's not in this book, but the march to Atlanta with the scorched earth policy. And you'd never heard of Longstreet really, unless you cared more or less. But the funny thing is this book changed the way I thought about General Lee, even just from the point of view of the actions taken as reported.
So it made you feel more negatively for him?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, because I also was taught great soldier, as well as great man. And then it made me think about the fact that fairly recently, whenever the girls were in high school and taking these various history classes, one of them had to do a report on General Sherman and found some stuff out about that, where I was like, oh, I can't hate him anymore for that stuff. It was admirable. He was doing it for the same reason that whatever you think of it, for the same reason that they bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because he was like, they're never going to stop unless they see they've been well and truly beaten. This war is going to drag on forever. And the point of war is hell, and my job is to make it worse so that you stop. That's the only way to stop it, is to make you feel it. And I went, oh. I respect you now.
Yeah, interesting.
And so
interesting. You know,
did that for me.
Yeah, that's good.
It did it for me.
Yeah, I am not a Civil War buff by any stretch of the imagination. But I read this book at a time when I was kind of working my way through the Pulitzer-winning novels. And it's one that I happened to have found. I said, oh, yeah, this is one of them. So I grabbed it. And what it's about, it's specifically about the Battle of Gettysburg. From July 1st to July 3rd, 1863. And Michael Shera is an author that I learned a little bit about in the last few days, some things I didn't know. He was known primarily as a short fiction writer. He wrote some science fiction.
I read that.
Yeah, mostly in the 1950s.
Okay.
And he has a short story collection that I may try to find. You know, it looks like it's out of print. It's a Timescape paperback called Soldier Boy. And it was published in 1982. Now, the audiobook has an introduction by Jeff Shera, his son. Did your book have that?
No. And is he the one who's also gone on and written some other Civil War books?
Yeah. He wrote a sequel to Killer Angels and then a prequel. None of which I've read. And then he's written some World War II things. So he's kind of made a career out of this style of novel.
Okay, I was wondering if you knew anything about those.
Yeah, but I haven't read any of them.
Okay.
But anyway, in the introduction, it was all about his dad. And a couple of interesting things in there is his dad wrote the book, had trouble getting it published, finally did. And then, sales were very, very slow. And then he got a letter in the mail, and it said, hey, guess what? You've just won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, just blew him away, of course.
Yeah.
And then he expected, holy cow, I've made it. I've really made it, but nothing changed. His book continued to just not sell at all. So then some years later, somebody approached him about making a movie. And the movie eventually was called Gettysburg, and it was financed by the guy who used to own CNN. Ted Turner.
Oh, okay.
So it was eventually made, but it was made after Michael Shera died. Michael Shera died in 1988, and I think the movie came out in 1992. After that movie came out, the Killer Angels hit the bestseller list.
Yeah.
So poor Michael Shera Shera. I know it's pronounced Shera because... Jeff Shera himself pronounced it on the audiobook.
Well,
so I assume he's an authority.
Yeah. One hopes he knows how to say his last name. Otherwise, it's hard to read his book.
Right, right.
Well, so, so it was truly a labor of love because the introduction, it was just a brief introduction in mind, said, you know, we went on a family vacation, and I started thinking, I wrote a book based on their points of view.
Yeah, yeah.
As I could find them, and I thought that was really... admirable.
Yeah, it is admirable. And he said he wrote it, I can't remember what he compared it to. Red Badge of Courage.
That's
Stephen
it.
Crane.
Stephen Crane.
Yeah, Stephen Crane said, I wanted to know what it was like, you know, not just in the history books, but I wanted to know what it was like to smell and to see their faces and everything. And he said, that's exactly the same reason I wrote this book, is because it was an inner exploration of the whole event. And getting into it in the kind of detail you need to get into it to write a novel really puts you in there. And,
it was so well done. And I have to say, even though I was complaining about maps, eventually I was looking forward to them. I'd be going, wait, because I felt like I knew all these people. He had a rare talent because he talked about, and I could see it from the foreword where he's here are the armies and he characterizes them a little. And then he says the men. So then he talks about the Confederate men, you know, the generals basically, and some commanders and things. And then, you know, these men wore blue. So the Union guys. And, which just occurs to me, if you're not from this country, sorry, but most Americans, this is something they know the basic things about. And Gettysburg is one of those battles that everybody knows was a big turning point.
Right.
But I never would have thought of looking into it. But just the way he described these people, you suddenly went, wow, this isn't the usual way you read about people being described. And he's also talking about these two people were good friends, and now they're fighting on opposite sides. But whenever they're fighting in the same area, they try to get together, and you're just like, what?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I know really it's a total cliche to say that a book puts you there. I can't describe this book, you know, enough. I mean, it affected me deeply when I read it the first time.
And I can't remember if I told you this in an email, but there was one point, and it's Chamberlain, who's one of the main guys on the Union side eventually, just through sheer dumb luck. A battle has been fought, and you're looking at it from his point of view. And when it got done, I had to stop and put the book down because I was breathless. I had to actually just sit there and breathe. You know, Tom's looking over at me like, are you okay? And I'm just like, yes, but it was like I was there. It was crazy good. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, and I felt the same way. I mean, so many times in this book, it was just you know, I'm sure it was affected by the fact that I knew that these were real people. And
yeah,
you know, just reading this and these guys' doubts and fears and what it's like to, you know, face death, situations where they are almost positive they're not going to get out of this thing. And yet they go ahead and they do it anyway. And the feelings that they have and how it was described.
It wasn't written about in a cliched way because, you know, you're saying those things and they're all so true and I really felt them myself. And I think, but if I heard that description, I'd be going, oh, yes, their doubts, their fears, their blah, blah. But no, I'm not. No, really. He did this differently. He did this so you care. He didn't make it sentimental. He didn't. You're seeing the just, you know, they're men with things to deal with.
Yeah.
The guy who's Chamberlain, who's running his little main outfit, which was at one time 1,000 strong, and is now down to 200 men, and they dump on him. Oh, here's another 120 guys from Maine. Sorry, you have to guard them because they're mutineers.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, holy moly, what am I? We can't even guard ourselves. What are you talking about? And he's got to figure a way out of it. And then you find out he's a professor, and he's like, well, I'm not going to turn guns on Americans. You know, I'm not doing that to these soldiers, but I will talk to them. I've been told I'm good at talking.
Yeah.
And he is.
Yeah.
Or Longstreet, who I didn't really know much. I knew the name.
Mm-hmm.
But you see a lot. I kind of came out of it with a little crush on Longstreet, I have to say. I'm famously stubborn myself, and I could admire that stubborn old man, especially since he was right the whole time.
Yes,
just like,
he was right. Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing that sunk in, it finally sunk in, you know, after my history classes and all this stuff, you know, I read this novel, and then I understood what it meant that these guys were fighting together like 10 years earlier somewhere else, you know.
Yes.
They were on the same side, and now all of a sudden they're fighting each other. And not only that, but they, you know, all this death, and yet both sides had such doubt about whether they were right or not, you know, if the characterizations were true. You know what I mean?
Well, not everybody did.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm sure that that's true.
But some of the but he wasn't afraid to characterize people with the doubts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the other people, or you know, people who had different motivations. Like, you know, Longstreet always says, you know, the Southerners, the cause, capitalized, and he's like, my cause is victory. I'm a professional. But by the very end of the book, you know, he allows himself to feel more about it, and. I don't want to give things away.
No, it's
not like it's like we don't know who wins, you know, or anything. But by the end of the book, as a good person raised in Kansas who knows which side should have won, and it's the side that should have won, because it's not like, as I was telling you, it's not like anybody in my household's thinking the South should have had slaves, but they're pretty sure about the cause, and we had quite the discussion about it two nights ago, thanks to this book. So thanks for nothing.
Hopefully no permanent damage was done.
No permanent damage, but uh-huh. It did take us into, I mean, my daughter was talking about, she goes, well, you know, the same things that we're arguing about today are the same things they were arguing about then, states' rights. And she was thinking of abortion. She said, but it's the other side now. Now it's the federal government who is imposing this on, you know, not letting states change their minds and stuff. And I don't know.
Yeah. It was just interesting. It's such a difficult thing. I remember somebody told me once, I must have been just a few years out of high school, and this guy said, you know what was the biggest power grab in the history of the world? And I said, what? And he said, it was Abraham Lincoln grabbing the power for the federal government.
Whoa.
And I was like, well, that's interesting, you know. And then, you know, that just kind of sticks in there as you go. And I am very much a states' rights person.
Same.
You know, I just think that stronger states is the way to go. And then at the same time, you know, slavery can't stand. You know, that is such a moral wrong that once they finally came to grips and said, you know, this is a moral wrong, how can you not fight for that cause?
Well, and the whole history of America, I mean, and this I'm basing on Paul Johnson's History of the American People, which I haven't read, but everybody else in the household read it, so I got told a lot of pieces of it by everyone. And according to that, they always knew slavery was a problem, but they were able to kind of shove it off in a corner here and shove it off in a corner there, and finally just things came to a state where it couldn't be ignored anymore.
You know, I was in that play 1776 last summer.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a part in there that I wanted to look up for historical accuracy, and it looks like that it was definitely discussed, but slavery was a sticking point in the play for the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And it's interesting, you know, so that long ago, back in, you know, what, 1776, they're talking about that.
I know.
It was already split between the North and the South at that point. And then according to the play, and again, you know, I'm no scholar, so I don't know if this is really accurate or not, but, you know, a compromise was made to leave slavery out of just not commented on in the Declaration of Independence.
But I remember hearing that also.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if it was one of the scholars in the household who mentioned it in passing or somewhere else, but, yeah, I remember hearing that. And so it would come up. And then go, well, this is more important. And but, you know, and I think what it did, it's interesting because it kind of shows that that's a continual tension in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the issue is, I mean, even to the point of, you know, like when we got done talking on Skype with Rose and I said something about, because, you know, the two people from Texas were definitely like, okay, no slaves ever. We get that. That's definitely wrong. Can't do it. But they were wrong to impose their will. And I was like, well, but, you know, you can't have a country where everybody's constantly leaving. You have to draw the line somewhere. Mm-hmm. And Tom turned around after we got off the phone, and I said something else about that, too. And he's like, you know, I think the right side won, too. However, the trouble we're having now is because of weak states' rights. And what do you do about states like Arizona with this weird immigration law, and also Alabama, where they will come down on, like, you know, a priest for letting an illegal immigrant go to their Bible studies because they're in their church or something.
Yeah.
You know, they're being so stringent. He goes, well, you know, you can't let that stand either. So weird.
Yeah,
and I said, well, to me, it comes down to the people in those areas should be good enough people to make it go away, to make it stop.
Yeah.
But that doesn't always happen.
And I think, you know,
and then you get that tension.
Locally is where it works. You know?
Right.
And the federal government continues to do mandates and various things that make, you know, Idaho is just not the same as New York. It is not.
Right.
And they just need to both coexist. And Idaho doesn't need the same laws as New York does.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to I heard in a discussion one time, you know, the ridiculousness of allowing a 14-year-old to get an abortion without ever notifying a parent.
Yeah.
You know, this same guy that I saw say that in this discussion said, I mean, I won't let my daughter pick her own orthodontist. You know?
Yeah.
And it's so true.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, to a certain mindset, that's logical. And the reason that that's logical is because of us on the other side that are trying to impose our will on that. But it's ridiculous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, if the states were just self-contained states and the federal government was just doing the few things that the Constitution says that they should do, then I imagine we'd all be getting along pretty well.
Yeah. It
you know, I'd like to think so anyway, but, you know, maybe, yeah. Maybe not. Maybe
no,
we'll be at civil war.
I think it'll be a lot more like Italy.
Uh-huh. And I don't know much about Italy.
Well, I just think about Italy, and it was until, my gosh, maybe just 100 years ago, it was all these little kingdoms.
Oh, we read a book.
Yeah.
Prince of Foxes.
Yeah. So it was all these little kingdoms, and they coexisted, but they weren't really cooperating.
Yes.
And I think that's where the tension comes in. The tension comes in how many of your rights do you give over to the federal government to make it better for everyone, but how far do they go before they're stomping you? And, of course, someday, if we keep going long enough and long book time comes around where I'm like, long book time for me, Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Oh, okay.
And states a lot of that stuff wonderfully, I think.
Oh, good.
As well as being kind of a melodramatic soap opera that's got a zillion cliffhangers. So you really can't lose.
You bet.
But in this book, they get into that whole issue of what's everybody fighting for through the viewpoint, really, of Longstreet, and General Longstreet, and is it Captain Chamberlain? He's, you know, mm-hmm. he just winds up... Poor guy. There, and I have to say, there's a certain humor in the way this book is written because he winds up, you know, pulling off some amazing thing one day just by because when the guy said, you can't let anybody get past you or the whole army goes down. And he's like,
right,
okay.
Yeah.
And I won't tell because going through it with him and having him think of it is just wonderful. But then the next day they're like, okay, we're going to give you a break. We're taking over here. We're going to move you to a nice, safe place. The center. And I just sat there and laughed my head off because I had just have read about how, well, what we're going to do on the other side, we're going to concentrate everything on the center. And you're just like, oh no, they don't even have the ammunition. They haven't eaten all day.
Yeah.
So,
oh yeah. And you're reading about guys, you know, their feet are bleeding and it's incredibly hot. I mean, it's July, 1, 2, and 3. Just miserable.
Yeah, the whole time just kept going, could somebody at least give them something to eat? They can't fight without having eaten, but I guess they could.
I guess you do what you have to do, huh?
Well, I think that's what it came down to. But I think the thing, too, is they kind of point that out through Chamberlain. What's reality versus what's, I keep thinking theology, but that's not it. But basically, idealism.
Yeah.
And that's
there was
kind
a
of
really, yeah.
States' rights versus federal.
Yeah, sure. I think it was early in the book. I jotted down a note that says a new faith.
I marked it here.
Yeah. Somebody said they were likening the patriotism, I believe, is how I'd put it. Although I don't know that he used the word patriotism as almost a new faith.
Is this in the southern? Okay, I did not mark that down.
I believe it was one of the northern folks said that.
What?
And then in the same area, it says a man who's been shot at is a new realist. And what do you say to a realist when the war is a war of ideals?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing of... the speech that Chamberlain gives early on when he's talking to the mutineers, and he's like, well, I'm just going to tell them how things are. And he kind of looks around and he says, some of us volunteered to fight for the Union. Some came in mainly because we were bored at home, and this looked like it might be fun. Some came because we were ashamed not to. Many of us came because it was the right thing to do. All of us have seen men die. Most of us never saw a black man back home. We think on that too, but freedom is not just a word. And then he says it's a different kind of army because most armies in history have been fighting for land or loot. And he goes, we're fighting to set other people free. And then he said something which I thought was brilliant, and this made me think of Firefly because that's where I go with this, I guess. But he says, it isn't land. There's always more land. The idea that we all have value. You and me, we're worth something more than dirt. I never saw dirt I'd die for. But I'm not asking you to come and join us and fight for dirt. What we're all fighting for in the end is each other.
Yeah, that's great.
And that whole thing about we're not fighting for dirt, we're fighting for something real. And then, later in the book, he sees his first black man.
Mm-hmm.
And he's ashamed to admit that he's repelled. And the guy is probably really, really black. I can't remember, but he's only been in this country for like 3 weeks or 3 months. He's an African slave. And so it's the contrast there between, all right, here's the reality of what you're fighting for. And it's okay that he's got to adjust to it, you know, I think.
Yeah.
He doesn't stop fighting. It doesn't change what he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
But it puts a face on it. It makes it tangible.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you get the feeling, well, I get the feeling from that from the northern perspective, they're fighting against slavery.
Yeah.
At least that's what the men are feeling, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
the super intellectuals like Chamberlain who stop and they've had all those arguments with other people and think about it too much.
Right.
Everybody else just, yeah, go ahead.
And then I was just going to say, but the South is not defending slavery. At least that's what they're thinking.
Nope.
Right.
They say they're fighting
for freedom. We're fighting for freedom.
States' rights. Yeah, they're like, you know, you can't make us do this. It's not in the Constitution. It's not constitutional. I think that's true. They didn't give a lot of real defined power. But
there wasn't an exit strategy in there saying if a state doesn't want to be in there, they can do this, not that I recall.
Yeah, they never thought about the fact that.
But it does list what federal powers are,
right?
And it says everything else is not
right. Well,
it's in there,
and you know, and in this conversation I was having, because you know, it's not the people are still fighting the war, but when it comes to talking about it, they're still fighting the damn war. And
yeah, and, I mean, it's funny because I mean, we've been talking for a half an hour, and we're back kind of almost where we started again,
right?
You know, it's just because it's such a difficult issue.
And plus, to people like me who I had never been to the South, I mean, you know, I moved to Texas. That's fine, all this. And then I start dating this guy who turns out later to be my husband. So I like him pretty much. So we go to Austin to visit some of his family. And we're out. And then, let's look at the state capitol building. Okay, let's. And I'm like, there's all these big statues on the lawn. Let's look at them. And this giant one, four-sided things carved all over it, all these men standing there looking proud and soldierly, and it's like, in honor of the men who died fighting for states' rights. And I'm standing there, and I read this, and I'm like, what are they talking about? And my husband, Tom, my date at that time, looks at me, and he's just like, the Civil War. And I said, what? No, that was slavery. And he goes, no, it was about states' rights. They say it's slavery, but it was about states' rights. And I just looked at him, and because we were dating and everything, I just went, oh, okay. And then he kind of went, let me explain more. And I was like, all right. and I understand the point. It's what you and I have just been talking about. But, you know, Rose brought it up again. Mm-hmm. And she made the point that she says, you know, she could tell every teacher she'd ever had who taught history about the Civil War, if they were from the North or the South. She goes, this one guy, and I remember him, nice guy, super liberal and everything. If you could stretch it and interpret it Catholic-wise to be super, you know, laissez-faire kind of stuff, do it. Mm-hmm. But the Civil War was about states' rights. It didn't matter. And everybody's like, slavery was wrong, no doubt, but they were wrong to do it the way they did. And that's and she goes, Dr. Morris, in high school, it was about slavery. She goes, he's from New York. I'm like, yeah, and I suddenly went, oh my gosh, somewhere, and I couldn't find it in time to do this, but I was like, somewhere there's a point where Longstreet at the very end, after denying it all those times, he thinks to himself, it's about slavery. And that's when I was like, I'm sorry, he would never have thought that. Michael Cera, I don't know where you're from, but I know it's in the North, you know?
And I think you're right. I think I read New Jersey, unless I'm mistaken.
Funny. He pulled that out of a journal or something, and so it actually is. But to me, all the stuff they were thinking like that, that's the characterization that he was doing. And I'm like, no, you're not allowed to have that. Because I live with these people. I'm just telling you. And, I'm into states' rights, and that's great. But I'm the one who was going, I'm just telling you, the right side won the war. And like I say, that's when Tom's like, I agree. But, and they just let it die.
Yeah, and amongst all these thoughts and feelings, people are getting shot.
Yeah, because
by the hundreds.
The reality, and I was kind of thinking about it in terms of this Health and Human Services mandate, and I was thinking, see, this the idea of we're not fighting for dirt, this is for someone's freedom, that's the point we're at now. Now, the point, if the Obama administration does not back down, and the Catholics and everybody else of faith who doesn't want to follow their rules has to start shutting things down or going to jail, that's when we will, in essence, see our first black man. How far are we going to go?
Yeah.
Are we going to really go out there and fight and watch people die next to us? And that's, I mean, like the guys in the book did. Do we really believe it?
Yeah.
Because I had a talk with a priest recently, and we were talking about it, and I was, like, really bummed out about some things, and I was hoping he'd pep me up. Unfortunately, he was also bummed out, so. And he goes, well, I just have to say, if it comes down to civil disobedience, I'm not cut out for it. I'll just retire. And I was like, oh, you can't do that. We all have to do our part. And he goes, well, I can't do that. And I was like, I was really disillusioned.
Wow, yeah.
You know, I was like, no, we have to all, like, link arms and stand there and whatever it is we're supposed to do, you know. But that's the different, but that's the same in a, on a very small level. That's what this book is about.
Yeah, well, that's going to be a remarkable day.
I hope it never comes.
I mean, how can he not realize that, you know, you're chopping at the very foundation? It's like, this far and no further was a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's about time everybody stood up. And that, and see, that's what it comes down to for this. When we say, how can they go so long and then only, it's like this, everybody kind of let it go and let it go and let it go for whatever reasons, a lot of different reasons. And now finally it's to the point where it's like, you know what? We can't look the other way anymore.
Yeah.
This is too much.
It is.
And everybody's like, well, now why do you guys care now? Well, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But this, I guess we...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're just making it impossible for us to live the life that we want to live. And, you know, we need to all coexist.
Well, right. And like Rose said, it's flipped. Now it's the big government going, we are going to take away people's rights and deny them the right to life, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, for Catholics and any religious people that, you know, abortion and contraception, all this stuff that's worked in there, that's what that means. Well, before it was the other way. They were like, no, you can't do that to these people. You can't enslave them. You can't treat them like property. Well, and that's kind of why I thought of Firefly, because I thought, you know, the whole situation was like watching somebody who'd lost the Civil War and was just going to live on the fringes in the West as best they could, because they weren't going to live under that big government that was going to push you around and rule you. And I'm sure that's how the South felt. I mean, we know that's
how
they felt.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, too. Yeah, we should mention that one of the reasons why Firefly is coming up in this conversation is because Joss Whedon was actually influenced by this book, you know, before he started Firefly, and according to Wikipedia. And I believe that that's so because... in that episode, Objects in Space, the bounty hunter's name is Jubal Early,
mm-hmm.
who is one of the generals in
right.
this book.
One of the Civil War generals.
Yeah.
An angry man.
And, you know, the language that they use in the book is similar to how Firefly sounds.
Yeah. Western type.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and in a sense, I liked, I guess I related a lot to Chamberlain because he was given a lot of the intellectual quandaries to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his brother didn't seem to have any of those problems. He just, oh, okay, here we are again. Woo! That was a heck of a fight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And he talks at one point about before he went off and ran away, essentially, and joined the army, this talk he had with a minister and a professor, I think it was, and they were both on the side of slavery. And so the minister was just kind of, and so he wasn't bothered by that. But then the other guy comes back, the professor comes back, and he apologizes for doing this in his home. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he says, but then he pointed out that he could not apologize for his views because they were honestly held. And I had to see that he was right there. Then he talked to me for a while, and he was trying to get through to me, just as I had tried with the minister. The difference was that this was a brilliant man. He explained the minister was a moral man, kind to his children, and that the minister believed every word he said, just as I was, because I was really thinking of killing him, wiping him off the earth. And then I realized for the first time, if it was necessary to kill them, then I would kill them.
Hmm.
And... Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, we've had those moments, all of us, where you suddenly have this doubt cast on what you absolutely have thought through and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean you don't kind of go, well, whoa, everything's upside down. And then you kind of go, well, wait, let me rethink it.
Uh-huh.
But I thought that was so well articulated.
It sure
because
is.
That's, yeah, that's when he realized, wow, we are all fighting a war of conscience. We really do believe all this stuff. And he's, and like you said, this guy was brilliant. He wasn't somebody he could dismiss like, oh, that stupid minister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and then what about Robert E. Lee? We haven't talked too much about him.
Yeah.
He wrote, you know, Shara wrote a lot of really flattering things about him.
I think everyone
one of the
loved
things.
It.
Yeah, I marked this passage. I thought this was interesting. Quiet spread out from Lee. The old man stepped out into the light, came forward. Stewart swung to look. Longstreet saw men beginning to take off their hats in the old man's presence. Lee mm-hmm. came up to Longstreet's horse, put out his hand, said something very soft. Longstreet took the hand. There was no strength in it. Lee was saying that he was glad to see him well. And there was that extraordinary flame in the dark eyes, concern of a loving father, that flicked all of Longstreet's defenses aside and penetrated to the lonely man within like a bright hot spear. And Longstreet nodded, grumbled, and got down from the horse. But he's constantly saying great things about Lee. Another moment I remember is when a soldier came to Lee and said that the southern soldiers had commandeered a shoe factory and were making themselves shoes and taking what they wanted.
Yeah.
And then somebody came to him and said, this man wants to see you because we stole his blind horse like you told
right.
us to do. And Lee said, hey, we have to be kind.
Right.
Give him back his horse, you know, and we're going to be honorable and kind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there was a lot of good stuff about Lee. And then for whatever reason, I'm interested in what you think the reason might mm-hmm. be, he was so stubborn in doing the wrong thing, even in the face of people like Longstreet saying, you're going to get us all killed. This is not the right thing to do. This is a no-win situation. We've got to do it differently.
He's saying, look at the ground. Look at the ground. It's not good ground.
Mm-hmm. And Lee just said, no, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And, of course, history is history, right?
Yeah, I know. And it's a good thing I wasn't running things because, like I say, by the end of the book, I wanted both sides to win.
Uh-huh.
Because I liked everybody so much. And you like Lee, the way he's shown, because even when you're shown what he's thinking and his point of view, he's trying so hard to do the right thing. But you kind of get the feeling he's, like, worn out. He doesn't have anything he can depend on except Longstreet, really.
Yeah, like it was in that passage I read, it said that there was no strength in him.
Yeah.
He was having heart trouble. What is he, 57 or something when this battle took place?
Yeah, and not had an easy life. I mean, I think he'd been a soldier all the time. But he also was kind of interesting because he was like a good soldier, but he also had this feeling of, you know, is God on our side? And he couldn't fight a defensive war. And what I was thinking about is fairly early on, Longstreet is talking to Armistead,
mm-hmm.
who was also a general under him, though. And he was saying that, you know, well, what do you think? Because I think defensive war, and Lee promised me he was going to do it this time. And Armistead's like, look, I've been looking at what you think, and you're brilliant, okay? It's going to work. You're probably right. This is maybe the best time. But, Pete, this ain't the army for it. We aren't bred for that defense. And the old man, Lord, if there was ever a man not suited for a slow, dull defense, it's old R.E. Longstreet said, but he's a soldier. Exactly, and so are you, but the old man is just plain, well, too proud, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he's like, he wants to face them face to face, and he wants to go at them, and the morale of the men is high, and they can do it for him. And they all keep thinking, the morale of the men is high, and they can do it for him. And when the armies are described at the very beginning, they say that, you know, the Southern soldiers, they have a common cause, they believe in their leaders, they have great confidence in them. And then they talk about the Northern Army, and they say they don't have very much in common at all. And they really don't trust their leaders, but they have confidence in themselves and their abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that allowed, you know, there to be more sergeant types, like in mm-hmm. this battle anyway, where Chamberlain, you know, here, go do this, and everybody would go do what they're supposed to do, and they had confidence. Whereas everybody else is like, Lee said it, I'm doing it. It's Gallipoli all over again, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Do you happen to know, is there any controversy? Are there people that believe, for example, that Lee couldn't have made that mistake?
Well, the end of the book made it sound like it.
Yeah. I'm just wondering. Yeah, Longstreet was blamed, and Longstreet was the one who finally, and right before the last day, got the courage to tell Lee himself that he was wrong,
mm-hmm.
and this is not going to work. And then mm-hmm. Lee just says, oh, they'll fall.
Just ignored it. They have to.
They'll fall.
Do it.
Yeah, and then in kind of the afterward, didn't Michael Sheriff say that Lee said that God's will had been done?
Yeah.
God had decided this?
And everybody liked to blame Longstreet because they mm-hmm. just felt that Lee wouldn't have done that. Because
yeah, to the point where Longstreet wasn't even invited to ceremonies.
Right, one of those reunions.
Yeah.
It was, I'm looking at it here. And I loved this. Well, and plus the thing it says, after the war, he makes two great mistakes. First, he becomes a Republican, attempts to join with old comrade Grant in rebuilding the South, because he really does look at it like a job. He's like, here's how you do this. You just don't let it get that personal. It is personal, but, you know, you overcome it. And he says, for this, he's branded a turncoat. Within 2 years of the war, he is being referred to by Southern newspapers as the most hated man in the South. And it says, then as time passes and it becomes apparent that the war was lost at Gettysburg, he gives his opinion, which is he believes the war was lost by Robert E. Lee. And then everybody's like, oh, now we really hate you because Lee's dead.
Yeah.
You have just, you know, thrown a stone at Jesus right in front of us, basically. And so it says, at the great reunion years later of the Army of Northern Virginia, Longstreet is not even invited, but he comes anyway, stubborn to the end, walks down the aisle in his old gray uniform. And I was like, good for you.
Yeah.
I love that.
And not only that, read the next sentence.
Yeah, that says, stars of a general on his collar, and is received by a tremendous ovation by the men with tears and an embrace by Jefferson Davis.
Fantastic.
His theories on defensive warfare are generations ahead of his time.
How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the men knew what happened.
I didn't realize he died in 1904.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, 83.
Wow.
Crazy. Wow. Yeah.
That's something else.
It says the generals of Europe are still ordering massed assaults against fortified positions long after his death. So mm-hmm. in that sense, you can't, I didn't really think about that till I read it out loud, but you can't blame Lee. Mm-hmm. He was doing what all generals always did, but he didn't, he wanted Longstreet, but he didn't trust him enough.
Yeah. And he kept telling, I mean, I can recall three times in the book where he told Longstreet, I need you.
Yeah.
And he was basically, you know, it was like he felt that he was turning against him. And he was like, you know, you don't understand. You've got to do what I say, and I need you to, because I can't do this without you. And then Longstreet just felt obligated and obligated. And then, you know, like, that's interesting because
there could be a chance. He says, if everything goes just right, it could work. So he had to try because everybody else was going to throw their men out there. If he didn't throw his men out there too, they would have no chance.
Yeah. This reminds me a little bit about Dune and Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert.
I love Dune, but I never read Dune Messiah.
Yeah. Now, Paul Atreides was a Messiah figure, right, in Dune. And then when he got to writing Dune Messiah, what he was thinking about was leaders in which we have blind faith. He's not thinking Christ. He's thinking John F. Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so he's thinking, you know, we make errors when we have a charismatic leader of that magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And we put our faith in him and we start to get blind to certain things. So Dune Messiah is about the fall of Paul Atreides now that he's got all this power.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really interesting approach and one that I've never seen, which is why I like it. It's so atypical of a hero. You know, you've got a big old hero in Dune and then an anti-hero in Dune Messiah, and it's the same guy. Mm-hmm. John W. Campbell hated it.
Oh.
But Frank,
well,
you know,
that's
yeah,
not his
so.
Style. He was always looking for something different than that. He was going for the adventure and the hero and the...
Right.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring that up is because you kind of see that here.
Oh,
Longstreet,
completely.
For a long time, could not get up the courage to tell Lee that he thought he was wrong. And he knew all the way down to his feet, he knew that he was wrong.
Yeah. Oh.
And he couldn't say, General Lee, this is
a
terrible idea, because he was Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, and you just made me think of the fact, which I knew from reading the book, but I hadn't really connected it with the opposition of it, is an unknown general had taken over, Meade. And they were like, oh, they don't have McClellan, who all the men loved the way they loved Lee, but on the Union side, right? So they pulled McClellan. Well, the men have no one now. And all the Southerners are going, this is great. Meade is going to be slow. He's not going to know what he's doing. He's going to want to wait a week or two to kind of figure out what's going on because he hasn't been in here. We're just going to knock him over. Well, what happens is everybody argues with Meade. Meade does want to wait and everything. And all the other generals go, nope, we're having a vote. Hands up, everyone. And Meade is the only one standing there going.
He's the only one standing there, and he made them all write it down.
Yeah.
You know, and
made them sign it. So
yeah, you can't run. You can't run things that way.
Yeah, it's, but what happened was, so the collective was given, it was, they said, you're the one who's blind, we know what's going on, and because there was no Messiah figure, so to speak, no beloved leader who had no flaws in their eyes, they had to all think for themselves. And
that's
it doesn't
really
mean that there weren't problems, but
that's
that was...
interesting, because they ended up with the right decision.
Yeah, that was the dynamic where it was really obvious. And I think on the other side, it was really obvious. I mean, you know, poor Pickett, he had the cavalry... Mm-hmm. No, he wasn't. But he was, you know, high spirits. We're going to do this for you, General. And his men have gone in there and just been cut to shreds. And he comes back to Lee and he's crying about it and everything. I mean, just he's broken up. And Lee's like, well, you got to go back out and do it again. And he goes, no, I can't. My men. And he's like, you have to do it. And he's like, I can't. There are no more men. I got like 10 guys. Okay. And I can't believe you're asking. I mean, he doesn't say it, but you can see at that point, he's like, you shouldn't be asking this of me. You should be looking at what's real. This isn't reality.
Yeah.
And because what I thought was interesting is the extent to which, you know, Lee would make up his mind as best as he could based on what he you know, had worked and all this stuff. That's fine. But then at the end, it says, you know, he knelt and began to pray. But while he's praying, he's still thinking. So he's not really praying. We've all had these experiences. I had it today at Daily Mass. I was there and I was like, I'm sorry I'm here, but I'm not here. My brain's just somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, he couldn't find a flaw. It says by the end of the prayer, he was certain. He felt a releasing feel. This thrill, this was the way as God would have it, face to face with the enemy on grounds of his own choosing, end with honor. And I'm like, whoa, wait, wow. Hold on. That's not what I want from a general. You know, and then he starts thinking about what'll it be like when I die.
Yeah, and those kind of thoughts just blew me away in this book. You know, when I'm reading them and the thoughts, I recall a scene where this kid was at the bottom of a hill, and the general runs by him and he says, "You got to get up the hill." And he says, "What will you think of yourself tomorrow?" You know, because the kid was like, I am so scared, I can't possibly go on this hill. You know, and just all these thoughts that you know, it just seemed like the author explored so many different possibilities of your reaction to this kind of extreme stress. And I thought it was interesting. One of the blurbs that really caught my eye was from Norman Schwarzkopf, who said this was the, what did he call it, the best description of what it's like to be in a battle.
Being in battle, I thought it said, because that also made me really interested in reading it, because you are given so much of what they think. And oh my gosh, I mean, he deserved the Pulitzer and any prize you can give him for the way that he used Chamberlain to show what it was like being the leader in that battle, in those two battles that you see him in.
Yeah.
You know, it's just because it's like you could imagine it would be under stress as you can't think anymore about, you know, he uses his own brother to plug a hole. He doesn't even think twice, like, this is what has to happen. Here, we're doing this, we're doing that. What can I think of? And he doesn't have time for emotion or anything. He's just solving one problem after another, thinking about it, going bigger. And it's the same thing in the second battle. And that's when he's like, it was beautiful watching all those guys march. You know,
I remember that. And he actually felt a love because of how they moved.
Yeah.
You know, when they moved into position, just like he taught them. And it was just like, that was the word that he used. It was like a love of them.
Well, and actually it's that, but it's also the Confederate guys coming toward him. It says, Chamberlain closed his eyes and saw it again. It was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. No book or music would have that beauty. He did not understand it. A mile of men flowing slowly, steadily, inevitably up the long green ground, dying all the while, coming to kill you, and the shell bursts appearing above them like instant white flowers, and the flags all tipping and fluttering, and dimly you could hear the music and the drums, and then you could hear the officers screaming. And yet even above your own fear came the sensation of unspeakable beauty. And then he says to himself, professor's mind, you know.
Wow, yeah.
Analyzing is. But that's kind of what his brother said. His brother said, didn't you love them even while we were killing him? It wasn't to the brother. It wasn't because they were beautiful. It's because they were like us. They were us. They were brave. I honor their bravery. I love them, even though we had to stop them.
Yeah.
You know, and that... I would say the thing that this book did for me above anything else, and obviously I loved it, was it made me understand that the people on both sides didn't necessarily hate each other, especially as individuals, because I was always taught, well, you know, it's awful. Brother fought brother, father fought son. And the scenes that you're always given in movies or books was, you know, hatred, because it's a huge fight. And one side leaves, and then they both fight each. You know, they're both fighting on opposite sides, so they're just all killing each other. But despite that, because of the way some of these officers were, and because of that kind of thing of the brother talking about, you know, but they were brave, and they were Americans still, you know, and I'm sorry that we had to do that, and I love them for it. And you understand that it wasn't just hatred.
Yeah.
It was just they were caught up in this big thing that had to be settled, even if they loved the people on the other side.
Yeah.
you know.
Fascinating thought. There's a quote at the beginning of the book. It's by E.M. Forster.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "I hate the idea of causes, and if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country."
Which is what Lee did.
Yeah.
And the thing is everyone understands it so well that even the people, the kids in the North are taught, it's okay. He did the right thing. He followed his conscience, you know?
Yeah.
Conscience is given a great value.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I don't know if you saw that quote that has been going around a little bit lately from Abraham Lincoln talking about, you know, Catholics have to be allowed to respect their consciences just like Protestants.
No, I haven't seen that.
I had it up on, I was pointing back to something else, but someone had seen it on somebody's Facebook thing and said, oh, well, I'm sure somebody made that, you know, and he's Catholic. Frank
yeah.
Weathers at Why I Am Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He said, well, we know how we can't really trust the internet. And so I'm sure somebody kind of tweaked it or found it somewhere else and put Lincoln's name on it. This is too good. In a sense, to be true. And actually, no, it was in a talk he gave at, I think it was a Whig speech or something, a Whig gathering. And because one of the big things was everybody's like, you can't trust these Catholics. You know what they're going to choose to make their decisions on. What if the Pope tells them to do something? You know, the same old thing.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, and you know, the Crusades make it look like that, so I got to give them some, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a whole paragraph about, no, we have to allow men their own consciences, and we have to trust that they're going to make the right decision. You can't, you know, and I was like, that's what this book is all about.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you can love the people on both sides, because Michael Sharon didn't choose sides before he started. He just wanted to see what happened.
Yeah.
And he allowed us to honestly, I think as honestly as he could, see both sides. And it's a rare book that does that, especially in this country, by an American, about the war.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you for forcing me.
You bet. Now, one thing that I'm really confused about, though, is where does the vampire slaying come into play?
Well, you know, we didn't
see that before the war or after the war?
We really didn't get to see Lincoln at all. So,
oh man, you know, I've seen ads for that movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, and God help me, I want to see it.
I guess maybe I'm embarrassing on my soul. I also
it looks
hoping
awesome.
That the reviews are good. I really want to see my old Abe on his face kick some ass.
That's okay? Going to be great.
With a steak.
I will definitely check that out.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, fun. Well, thanks again for reading this one. What do we got? What do we have coming up? Oh, yeah. It's my movie.
Your movie.
Yes, The Incredibles.
More heroics.
More heroic. Thrilling heroics, as Joss Whedon would say.
I like
and
it.
And less seriousness.
Less brother killing brother.
That's right. That's right. Oh, and yes, you changed our next book for an excellent reason.
I did, because we were going to read a book I was excited about last time, but then Ray Bradbury died. Ray Bradbury, thank you.
Yeah, thank you
he
so
gave
much.
Us so much.
He
and
sure did.
So I thought, you know what? I read Fahrenheit 451 once. I must have been in college or out of college. It's time to read it again. So I thought I would change it to that book in tribute of Ray Bradbury.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Or the second Ray Bradbury book we were doing, we did Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think they're written in a very different style, so I'm really interested to think about that too.
Yeah, me too.
And look at it. And, then after that is my movie, The Quiet Man.
The Quiet Man.
John Wayne going against type.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. It's all going to be good.
Good, good, good.
Yeah. So everybody get, you know, if you're visiting the Civil War places during the summer, take a copy of this with you and read it.
You bet. You know, I've never visited a Civil War battlefield, but I did visit one time Little Bighorn.
Oh.
Which is your South Dakota kind of my area.
Right? I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Yeah.
It came out. Come on.
My dad and I drove my brother to Rapid City, South Dakota, where he was going to college for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And on our way back, we stopped at this battlefield, the Little Bighorn, where Custer met his maker. And it was remarkable. I mean, that's the only time I've ever been in a place like that. And there was a park ranger there, I remember pretty clearly, and he was describing what had happened. Excellent storyteller. You laid all right out, and it was just like, oh, I can see this happening right in front of
me.
Yeah,
really the way the geography would help drive it and everything. Yeah. Well, I've been to most people don't think about it, but it's in Springfield, Missouri, just outside of it. And in fact, there's Battlefield Mall there and, you know, all this kind of thing in Springfield because of it. There was a little battle that happened there. And so it's a very small battlefield, but we went to the little museum with the kids one time and, you know, they had the little topography map with the little lights showing who did what. And I kind of looked at it, went, And then, but we drove around and we got out at the little places where they were kind of describing what happened. And then that kind of came back to me when I was reading this book, because I thought at the time, I thought, oh my gosh, they wouldn't have cut grass. They couldn't have seen anything. There would have been mosquitoes. It would have been hot in these uniforms. Mm. How does anybody know where anybody is?
Yeah.
So it was effective for that reason, because you couldn't really see. And then, of course, every time I go to the Alamo, and I love the Alamo, love it, I always stop and think how many people died there for, you know, a cause.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, you stand there and it's very humbling to go, people died here in a huge battle for something that mattered that much to them.
Yeah.
So
on the flip side, I also recall going to Tombstone, Arizona.
Oh.
Where this basically a street fight has got so famous for who knows what reason. But yeah, you know, these guys fought each other for almost no reason whatsoever.
Well, I could actually tell you quite a few of those reasons, because Tom got given for his birthday that there's a new book out that the guy went back to everybody's journals and letters and everything and has teased out all the many things that contributed and the series of weird events that kind of led up to everybody having that 30 seconds of, what? Full leather! And then I said, are you finally done with that thing? And he goes, oh, no. Now we have the trials and the countersuits.
Just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I haven't been there, but I did live in Dodge City for a year.
It was smaller than I thought it would be. It was just like, wow, these guys were pretty close together.
Well, it was
boom, boom, done.
Yeah, because it was from a silver mine.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and actually it wasn't at the OK Corral, because that's where everybody thought went to look first, but they weren't there, so they went to find them and then came across somebody who they thought was packing heat, but he wasn't. And it was just bad. It was very bad all around. And then everybody evidently hired really good lawyers. That's why so much trial afterward. There was, you know, everybody was backed by rich people and
lawyers for everybody.
It sounded like today, the way Tom was describing it. I'm like, you're kidding. Mm-hmm. That sounds just like these days. So
for sure.
Anyway.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, we'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. With a high flying
Zippy. Sorry, you bet.
Thanks a lot.
Right, thank you. We'll see everybody.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.